Support for WGTD's morning show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional morning show co-host. And we welcome you to the Monday morning show on WGTD HD. I'm Gregory Berg. We will be spending the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking about a topic of the utmost importance, weight loss. This is something that all kinds of Americans struggle with, sometimes with tragic results. And there is so much that is written, so much that is said about the importance of weight loss and various means of achieving that. And, of course, a lot of what is said and written ends up not being all that helpful. In fact, sometimes tragically counterproductive. I am very, very happy to be able to spend the next few minutes of the morning show speaking with someone who really knows what he's talking about, Dr. Louis Arone. And he is the author of a previous book called The Skinny and a new book called The Change Your Biology Diet, the proven program for lifelong weight loss. You may know the name Dr. Louis Arone for the fact that he really helped save the life of David Letterman. And David Letterman actually has written the foreword for this brand new book and obviously has deep reasons to appreciate Dr. Arone's wisdom and sensitivity when it comes to this important topic. Dr. Arone, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thanks for having me, Greg.
I wonder if we could just take a moment to talk about what it is that you do on a daily basis as director of the Weight Control Center at Weill Cornell Medical College. I understand from what you write in the book that this is really one of the oldest such centers in the country. Tell us under the circumstances under which it was created back in the late 1980s.
Sure. A lot of people don't even realize that what we do exists. And part of writing the book is to let people know that there's a specialty in treating weight problems, that it's not the old diet doctor concept. I'm one of the founders of and the chairman of the American Board of Obesity Medicine. There are specialists around the country who have advanced training and knowledge of how to treat weight problems. So when I first started this, the reason I got interested in obesity more than 25 years ago was that I could tell even back then that it seemed to be driving health problems. And I tried to get people to lose weight. This is back in the 80s and was completely unsuccessful. So I said, gee, I have to take a more focused approach on this. And so it took years, but we've come up with a number of strategies that work. And are they as effective as bariatric surgery, which is the most effective technique? Usually no, but many times they are. And the point is that in between going on a diet, going to Weight Watchers, doing those types of things, and surgery, there's a whole spectrum of treatment that is now available. This is what we do 24 hours a day. We have two endocrinologists, we have a nurse practitioner, we have other specialists, and we all focus on improving someone's health by treating their weight. Hmm. That is the focus of a center like ours.
I was really intrigued at one point in the book when you explain how you first became interested in the field of obesity treatment. It really wasn't a direct route. You were actually exploring the matter of cost-effective care. Tell us quickly how this led you into the field in which you have become such an important player.
Well, originally, I didn't know if you wanted to hear that part of the story, but originally we did a study showing that the biggest driver of health care cost was obesity, more than having other severe illnesses like gastrointestinal bleeding, heart failure. People who are obese cost far more. And again, this is in 1986. So I decided, gee, why don't we just treat obesity and that will reduce health care costs. I was in a fellowship that is funded by the Kaiser Foundation, and it focused on healthcare costs. But So then the next problem was, well, how do we treat this? And that led me on this tangent for the rest of my career. I was fortunate to be present for one of the major discoveries in understanding obesity, which is the discovery of the hormone leptin, which we now know is a hormone that comes from the fat cell. It tells the brain how much fat is stored. And when we think about obesity, what is obesity? It's not a disorder of willpower. What it is a disorder of the nerves in the brain that conduct signals from your fat cell, stomach, and intestine to the rest of your brain. Those nerves are resistant to the hormone leptin. And it's taken us 20 years to really figure this out, but that is the problem. Your brain, the nerves in your brain, don't properly receive this hormone, and as a result, you don't feel full, you have cravings, and even if you cut down on what you're eating, over time, your body fights back metabolically because it's not getting enough of the hormone.
Explain if that's somehow a mistake, that our body is poorly wired, or is there a reason why our body is wired in this way when it comes to leptin?
Well, we think that the system is rigged in that direction. So when you think about the genetic tendency to weight gain, it's basically a big part of it is this tendency to become resistant to the hormone. There are many others. There are dozens of causes of obesity, but this is the thing that makes it hard to lose weight once you've gained. And the thing that's so important for people to understand is that these nerves are injured or damaged by fattening food. When you feed fattening food to mice, what happens is the nerves get damaged. It's almost like a power surge in a transformer, right? Too much power comes in too quickly. The transformer is damaged. It blows up. That's what happens to the nerves in your brain. So eating fattening food damages the wiring that carries the signals from your fat cells to your brain. That is the disease that we talk about when we talk about obesity. Hmm. So the thing we constantly see are people who are ashamed. They're embarrassed. They're blamed by people. They feel guilty. And it's not that at all. It's that this physical thing has occurred. That is the disease.
Now, do we understand why this affects some people so much more than other people? Is it that someone who is severely obese has more severely, in a sense, poisoned their own system or destroyed these nerves? Or is it that perhaps they began with some propensity for their nerves to be maybe more fragile or more susceptible to this damage?
It's clearly that they're more susceptible to it. So, again, going back to studies in mice, which have been done in some of the best research institutions in the world, like Harvard, the University of Washington, is where they've really figured these things out. What they show is that you can breed animals to be completely resistant to this. So you can have animal mice who, no matter how much fattening food you give them, they never become obese. But interestingly, what's been found is there's a stem cell mechanism that repairs the nerves in this tiny part of your brain. There are only a couple of hundred nerves there, but those nerves are constantly being repaired. You can also breed mice who have a very weak repair mechanism, and they become very obese. So these are so again, there are many different causes, and that's part of what we discuss in the book, in the Change Your Biology Diet, is that becoming overweight and obese is not just a matter of eating too much and not exercising enough, although those are critical, not sleeping enough. The medicines that you may be taking, including over-the-counter sleep remedies, there are many causes for the weight gain of Americans, and at least 10 of them all going in the direction of weight gain.
Hmm. So we should not start out with the assumption about others or about ourselves that this begins with some kind of character flaw. I mean, on the other hand, I suppose one's character flaw can play a role. I mean, when it comes to implementing the changes necessary, that's a matter of willpower. But I think you're saying willpower is not at the heart of the cause of this problem.
What I'm saying is you can use willpower to try to fight it. And if it's not too powerful, then willpower could overcome it. But a lack of willpower is not the cause. Food is designed to, these days, to be highly desirable. And once that gets started, damage occurs, and that makes it more and more likely for you to lose to gain weight. So we see this constantly now, where we'll see people who start out gaining, and it's all we can do to stop the weight gain. It's very difficult, and they feel like they're possessed. They don't know why they're gaining. They say, I'm not eating very much. We believe those people. We believe you. We don't. Instead of in the old days, people would say, oh, this guy's obviously lying. We don't say that. We say, we believe you, and the controlling mechanism that should regulate your weight is has now lost control, and that's why you're gaining.
And this is a process which can be reversed.
Well, when you think about what does a diet do, many people lose weight, but how do you maintain that weight loss? What are the real issues? And we've been able to figure out, both from the point of diet and otherwise, what things can be done to help people to more easily maintain their weight loss. So a lot of people these days are on a paleo diet. They're eating protein, they're eating vegetables, but one day the urge to eat starches or sweets comes into their mind. And again, they start feeling guilty because they say, I know that this isn't good for me. What we find is that having starches and sweets tends to increase your appetite. I don't know if anyone has noticed this, but especially in the morning, if you have a donut, if you have toast, if you have cereal or instant oatmeal, people tend to be hungrier throughout the day. Not everybody, but many people will tend to be hungrier throughout the day and not as easily satisfied. So we find that one of the best appetite suppressants is having protein for breakfast, something like eggs or a protein shake or Greek yogurt. Greek yogurt has more protein than regular yogurt. Those kinds of things tend to stabilize blood sugar. They make it easier for people to control their eating throughout the day. The second thing that we found very recently is that the order in which you eat food has a profound impact on your blood sugar. So we did a study we published earlier this year where we just changed the order of food. On one day, we gave people with diabetes a roll followed by chicken and vegetables. And then on another day, a few days later, we just switched the order. We gave them the chicken and vegetables followed by the roll. And what we saw was completely amazing. On the day they had the roll first, their blood sugar doubled. On the day they had the chicken and vegetables first, it went up just 25%. Dramatic difference in blood sugar. So on the day they had the vegetables and the chicken, it just drifted up gradually rather than the usual spike and then crash later on. And we've now repeated this, and we see the exact same thing. More importantly, we see that a critical hormone, insulin, is reduced dramatically, one half the production of insulin in order to get the sugar under much, much better control. So in other words, you can get better blood sugar control with half the insulin if you have diabetes. That's a huge advance because you're eating the exact same food. You're not cutting down. And if you look at the net effect of that, you will be lower in weight if you do that, because the more insulin we give somebody, we find, the more weight they gain. So less insulin, less appetite, less storage of calories as fat, just from changing the order of your food. So the point I was getting at is that you're on a paleo diet, and how do you start developing cravings for sweets or starches? And so you start out having cereal in the morning because it's cold out, and you're starving, and you're off your diet. So we've been able to figure out exactly how you can reintroduce the carbs and not go crazy with your eating.
Right. And, of course, another recurrent theme in your book is the idea that deprivation, which so often is the hallmark of particularly some of these fad diets, is ultimately a counterproductive factor in all of this. You do not function well in the whole weight loss arc if you consciously or your body on some level is profoundly deprived. That is a destructive path, ultimately.
That's correct. I think that many people get into this where they're trying to hold off. It's like they're hanging on from a cliff by their fingernails. They just can't do it anymore, and then they just break and go completely off. That's not what's going to help you to maintain your weight loss. So basically, we found the safety valves, the way you can have the foods that your brain starts to crave without setting it off to eating everything in sight. It's interesting. I did an interview with the New York Fox Channel last week, and people have called me and told me that the hosts were talking about this yesterday, that they actually tried what I'm saying, which is to have the protein and vegetables first and have the carbs later, and said it's unbelievable the impact that it has had on their eating and how they feel. So, you know, I look at this as the next evolution of dietary recommendation. And it comes because this is what we do. So people come to us and say, well, I've tried everything and I can't lose weight. And if you look at it, when you look at what they tried this diet from a movie star and this diet from a political consultant and then this diet from a chef. Like, to me, that's not, you know, those are not for real. Those are not, you know, the real deal, because what do these people really know about making dietary recommendations? You might lose, but in the long run, you're just not going to get the kinds of ideas that you need to make this work.
And one of the things I appreciate about your book is the fact that you have come to understand that flexibility is a really important thing to consider and to try to include, that people are different, their lives are different, and you need to build a program for them that has some flexibility built into it, in which people can fold it into their own lives in the way that works for them.
Yes. So we work around the patient. So I've written this book to try to mimic coming to see us at the Comprehensive Weight Control Center, where everybody, people come from all over the world because whatever they were doing did not work. They have a health problem. They have one of the more than 50 health problems that's the direct result of an increase in body weight. And our goal is to get them to lose weight to improve their health problem. But all we see are people who have failed. And I give as evidence that our approach works. I have a job. If it didn't work, I would not have a job. That's the evidence that this works. I mean, we have studies showing it works, but it's very clear to me that we're doing things that people have never thought of. And the Change Your Biology diet is like coming to see us. You know, one of the most important ones that we see all the time are over-the-counter sleep remedies making people hungry or physically stopping them from losing weight. I can't tell you how many times we have found that someone is referred, they can't lose weight, we find they're taking one of those PM products. And all we do is change them to something else. Usually we will change them to melatonin, which is also available over-the-counter. It works very frequently. At least three-quarters of the people who take it can sleep better. And voila, all of a sudden they're able to lose weight.
Before we have to let you go, I want to be sure that we touch on a couple of other matters in your book. I want to make sure that you have a chance to say a word about activity and how you really encourage people to not necessarily think about hours on the treadmill, but rather fold a little more movement, in a sense, into your everyday life. Just quickly, what are you talking about there?
Well, when you look at what is it take to make this happen in the long run. We see if you want to go to the gym, that's great. But a lot of people find that they do it for a few weeks and then they don't have time. So if you don't, there are many ways, and we go through this in the book, to add more activity to your life. Walking up the stairs, parking further away in the parking lot. And then interval training. There are programs now which we talk about as short as 10 minutes a day, as short as 10 minutes a day. If you can do more, that's great. But if you can't, do the 10-minute-a-day program. Standing. When we see patients now, believe it or not, we stand. One of us will stand in the exam room to get that burn three times as many calories standing than sitting. So if you can stand the whole day, think about that effect on your metabolism.
I also want to make sure that we touch on the chapter in the book, which is called Winning the Hunger Games, in which you take us through 12 the breakthrough dozen, 12 proven strategies for successful weight control. And a couple of them, at least, we've already touched on. Could you share maybe just a couple more of these tidbits that in and of themselves can make a tremendous difference?
Sure. I think the most important one is not to drink any calories. We've cured people of their weight problem by stopping them from drinking juice and soda. That alone, that is far and away the, besides the ones that I've already described, protein for breakfast, having the vegetables and protein first. You know, if you can not have carbs, and that's the kind of approach that has worked for you, that's great. But if not, have the carbs at the end. It's almost as good. And the other thing, don't eat food that comes in a box. Things that come in a box, they're highly processed. So if you can avoid it, that's great. But if you have it towards the end of your meal. And probably the last one is that if all else fails and you have a significant weight problem, see an obesity medicine specialist. They're all around the country. There are now 1,500 of them, and they can help you to utilize more advanced strategies. There are medications that can help. We now have minimally invasive procedures where you're not hospitalized. You just come in, you go out, very simple. And we're getting more and more traction with these kinds of strategies in people with significant weight problems.
The book, once again, is The Change Your Biology Diet, The Proven Program for Lifelong Weight Loss. This is a program not designed for spectacular droppage of pounds in the matter of a few days. This is about adopting strategies that you can easily sustain for the rest of your life and achieve profound weight loss that will remain a new reality in your life. That's what it's all about. The book is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and the author, Dr. Louis Arone. Dr. Arone, what a pleasure and honor for me to speak with you. I think this is a conversation that's going to be helpful to a lot of people, and I hope a lot of people will seek out your fantastic book. Thank you so much.
Thanks very much, Greg. Really appreciate you having me on.
The time is 8:33. This is the Monday Morning Show on WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg. I hope you're staying warm on this bitterly cold Martin Luther King Day. We will give you the weather forecast at the top of the hour. We do want to remind you that today's midday report is preempted by live broadcast of Gateway's Martin Luther King Day celebration. Here's part two of today's morning show. Well, all of us eat, but not all of us eat very well or very wisely. And sometimes the choices that we make that are unwise choices have less to do with our own laziness or inattentiveness to matters regarding our own health and well-being. And sometimes it is more a result of sort of the world in which we live and the easiest choices with which we are confronted on a daily basis. And in other words, it's sometimes as though the system, if you will, is set up in such a way for us to make very, very poor choices about the kind of food we ourselves eat and provide for our families. And that's really part of the driving impetus behind a very intriguing new book called The Food Activist Handbook, Big and Small Things You Can Do to Help Provide Fresh, Healthy Food for Your Community. It's really the contention of the author, Ali Burlow, that the system needs to be changed and that there are ways in which we ourselves as citizens and consumers can change the world in which we live and change the way in which our own various communities take in food. It can make possible more and more people having a greater and greater access to better and better food. And it's a very, very intriguing notion, and she has done her homework, and the book is quite meticulously prepared. The book is published by Story, and Ali Berlow is also the author of The Mobile Poultry Slaughterhouse, the co-owner of the magazine Edible Vineyard, and the founder of Island Grown Initiative, a grassroots nonprofit group on Martha's Vineyard. Again, this book is called The Food Activist Handbook. Ali Berlow, we welcome you to The Morning Show.
Thank you, Greg. It's a pleasure to be here.
You begin the book, that is the introduction, with a personal story that may come as a bit of a surprise to our listeners. That is, it's a personal story which has, in some ways, just a tangential relationship to kind of the heart and soul of the matter. And yet it helps us understand why this is such an incredibly important issue for you. Tell our listeners about this story, which you share to open your introduction.
Yeah, so it's about my father and a diagram of my father's heart that my mother had kept on the kitchen cupboard. My father suffered from heart disease and food-related obesity, and consequently, his body created detours from blocked arteries to ways that the blood could circulate to and keep him alive. And that's what this diagram depicted from his surgeon. And, you know, my father passed away about 4 years ago. May his memory be a blessing. But it really kind of, as always, struck me that, you know, we create the detours that we need to in order to stay alive, essentially, in order to move our food from the fields to our plates. But are they the best ways possible for our own bodies?
So towards that end, you have designed all kinds of different things that one might pursue in terms of trying to better the intake of food in one's community, making more and more better food accessible. As you thought about trying to put a book together, where did you begin in order to try to tackle such a large, complex topic?
Right. Well, yeah, good question. You know, I began the book where I started, which was in my community about 10 years ago. I invited people from all over our food web, so clergy, grocers, farmers, fishermen, food writers, gardeners, and we got together. It was a working potluck with a purpose, I call it in the book, to discuss what is sustainability to us? What does that mean to us? Now I might change that word to resiliency. What does it mean to be resilient in your community in terms of food? And with that, we got our discussion going within our own community. What can we do? What do we want to do? And the first project we took on was to create a map of our community that showed where all the food farms are, so people could go directly to the farmer to buy the food. You have to remember, I'm not a farmer. I could never even, I'm actually barely a gardener. But what I can do well is bring people together. I can Google, I can research, I can help connect the dots. And then locally, we can decide and take actions that are small and doable, and hopefully with success, and continue to build on that incrementally.
I want you to explain one very intriguing line in the introduction when you write, "This book is a glean," G-L-E-A-N. That's a word we don't use very much in our common everyday language. What are you saying there? This book is a glean.
Well, I think people across the country, across the world, essentially, but this book is focused on in America. There's people doing incredible work across the country in their food systems. And when I say food systems, that means anything that it takes, the distribution, the growing of food, the processing of food, selling of food, cooking, the education, all these things to get our food to us. And there are farm-to-school programs. There are clergy working in these areas. There's policy work. It's really a 360-degree culturally time in this time look at our food system. And the gleaning part comes from, it's a biblical, you can trace it back to the Bible, saying where a farmer will raise food, and if you take it literally, they are commanded to leave food in the fields for other people to collect, the poor, the hungry, the disadvantaged. And so gleaning is really an act of two-part. You know, the farmer grows the food, and then we come to collect the food that's there left for us purposely to sustain it. And I use that metaphor in terms of all this terrific work happening in the country about how do people change it? How do they change it in their food system where they are locally? It's a very practical book, full of advice, tips, a section called You Can Do This. And that's all advice and information that I've gleaned as the gleaner to present to you, the reader.
I really enjoyed the first part of the book, chapter one, which is called simply Start, in which you are, of course, trying to encourage people to not be overly intimidated by the scope of the problem. And, of course, right. We're talking about something that of course, should be thought about on kind of national terms and even planetary terms, mm-hmm. And yet... in some ways, thinking about that too much just leaves us sort of paralyzed or feeling pretty much impotent in terms of what we ourselves could possibly do to make a difference. So you really encourage us to think about our own communities, even our own neighborhoods, and the difference we can make at that level. And one of your suggestions is holding something which you call a potluck with a purpose. Explain right. to our listeners what that's about.
Well, I think you hit on a nerve right here, too, is that there's incredibly good information about the troubles with our food system. Movies like Food, Inc. and Fed Up, Michael Pollan, fabulous writer, Omnivore's Dilemma. You know, those books, you know, left me feeling defeated and feeling overwhelmed. You know, how can I change this? Everything, the odds are stacked against me. But in order to, you know, feel empowered, I do what I do. I went to Google. You know, I researched. I looked around my community, and that's where the potluck with a purpose came through, was to gather people together from all different parts of our community, because food really is the thing that unites us, right? It brings us together. So in all different ways, everybody has to eat. So how are they eating? What are the interactions? So bringing that kind of as much as you can, you know, group together and listening to people. What are the problems that they're facing, and what are we doing right, and what can we do more of to do it better?
And I think one of the intriguing subsets in this first chapter, taking off on that idea of the potluck with a purpose, to gather people around a table who might share this concern or maybe to just really share different ideas on what might be done. But you also suggest something which you call a farmer's dinner, mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. there aren't enough of us who know enough farmers. I mean, probably right. most people in this day and age don't know any farmers at all and have only the vaguest notion even of what happens on a typical family-owned farm. Mm-hmm. And what do you think is most important about this kind of opportunity, this kind of occasion in which one would sit down across the table from farmers?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, it's bringing the farmers in. What I did was to bring them in, feed everybody really well. First of all, let's remember food does unite us. So when we have a potluck with a purpose, you know, it's great to bring in the types of food that you'd like to continue to eat. You know, fresh seasonal foods, things like that, and home-cooked foods. But, you know, really, when you can start to listen to what farmers need, and in our case, that was access to land, access to good housing for workers, and also a mobile, slaughterhouse, access to a slaughterhouse. And because those two other of those areas, land and housing, were taken care of by other nonprofits in the area, we focused on the mobile poultry slaughterhouse to build that. I mean, I didn't grow up thinking I would build a mobile poultry slaughterhouse to humanely slaughter animals, but animal welfare is one of my passions, and Temple Grandin is one of my heroes. So I, again, went back to using the skill set that I have in order to make that project. But that really came about by gathering people, farmers in this case, together to really listen and ask them, what do they need? How can we help you? How can we help you so you can grow more of the food, like the fresh food we were eating at that potluck, and that we want to continue to eat? So how can we help support our farmers? And this idea is also transferable if you don't live in a rural area such as I do.
Hmm. The second chapter of the book is called Educate, and you share some very, very good thoughts on how the school needs to be a part of this, not only concerns about what food is consumed at school, but also the whole notion of educating our children on where our food comes from and what's the difference between good food and not so good food. There are all kinds of interesting thoughts shared in this chapter. I wonder if you could take a moment to talk about something called Food Core. And we should mention that this is also kind of a recurring element in the book called What's Going On, in which you're really talking about, I think for the most part, things that are already out there, that are already in the world, but maybe aren't a part of your own community and maybe should be.
Well, Food Corps is a national program, a federal program, launched, it's fairly new, I would say, in the last few years, based on the AmeriCorps program. So it recruits and encourages youth, usually college-age folks, but not necessarily, to go out into communities that may be suffering from in food deserts or lack of access to fresh, healthy foods, and work in the schools, work with the youth there in order to develop farm-to-school programs, school gardens, and raise awareness about it. The farm-to-school program is really a national movement that is, I think, one of the top sea changers in our country. If we can get to the youth now and use schools as they should be used, as educational institutions, and that includes the cafeterias, you know, that's where we'll really create change, because these kids will grow up and they will become the voters, they will become the consumers driving the market, and they will be healthier people. Right now we spend about $174 billion a year on food-related public health issues.
Hmm.
So Food Corps is one of those programs that works directly on the ground in communities, helping youth and helping school systems and connecting the dots from the farmer to the school cafeteria.
Hmm. It's, I suppose, in a sense, part of this whole notion of farm to school, which also can involve actually the purchase of locally grown foods for children to consume. One of your suggestions is sometimes that can maybe be done on a fairly modest scale, but it's at least a start.
Right, right. You know, I encourage not to get overwhelmed again. And as you said, you know, let's start somewhere. And that's where the book, you know, really is. Like, just take that first step. When we started our farm-to-school program in our community, you know, one of the school's response was, we want to create a compost system, as they wanted to compost the food waste. It wasn't that they first wanted to build a school garden. They wanted to compost. And that we went with because that's where the energy in that particular school was focused. You know, we saw that there was support for that, and then we said, terrific, let's start with a compost, because if you start with a compost, pretty soon you're going to want to build a garden to use that compost, right? So you really should look for your openings in wherever your wherever they are in your community.
Hmm. In the chapter called Build, you are talking about really trying to build a more just system of food creation and distribution. And the part of that chapter that I think is especially intriguing is when you talk about creating a food hub. Explain to our listeners what a food hub is and what makes it so valuable in all this.
Yeah, it's a little bit of the jargon, but, you know, getting past the jargon, which is important because it's the definitions of things that unite us all, right? So food hub is where where basically if you've got farmers, for example, they're bringing their food to that area in order for it to be processed. And when I say that, that's from, you could be, you know, washing potatoes to taking the butternut squash that comes from the fields and cutting it up and packaging it. And then it's also, so it's acquiring it, it's processing it, and then it's distributing it from that location. And that solves a lot of problems for rural communities because farmers may be able to, you know, they're growing the food, but can they actually process it on their facility? Not all farmers are set up to do that or can meet the regulations of food safety to that level. So having a food hub where farmers can bring their food and that is safely regulated with food security, then that is a place that helps the farmer get their product into the marketplace. Mm.
Speaking of farmers, very intriguing information is shared about farms and about, for instance, the importance of farmers having a farm succession plan in terms of trying to pass their farm on to others who will continue to farm that land. You mentioned how you're originally from Madison, Wisconsin, and how it makes you so sad to drive through that countryside in and outside of Madison and seeing what used to be farmland turned into something else. And, of course, we need that beautiful farmland to be used well.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could also say a word about something you touched on briefly before, namely the so-called humane slaughterhouse. You care a great deal about the welfare of animals, although some people might say it's a contradiction in terms for a slaughterhouse to be humane. But I think you're making a very, very important point there. Just name one or two of the most important factors which can make such a place at least more humane than it otherwise or typically is.
Yeah. The handling of live animals can cause them great stress and actually releasing stress hormones into their bodies. And also, you know, who wants to cause animal stress? You know, it's a very uncomfortable situation. So the better actual handling of the live animals, that the animal may stay calm, and the more trained and cared for humans that run the slaughterhouse, then that will help keep everything calm. In the mobile poultry slaughterhouse, this is something that actually goes to the farm. So the animals never are transported on large trucks across great distances. So you're already, you know, minimizing that. I'm not going to lie and say it's completely eliminated because there's stress no matter what. But what we're trying to do is minimize it. And then all the offal, the inedible parts, those things after the slaughter, those things are also kept on the farm and composted, again, within the regulations. And I think the key part to also the humane slaughterhouse, which I know it sounds like a contradiction, but this is part of our humanity, is to keep the workers safe, not rushed, not paid by, quote, animals, not for speed. And the complete transparency is what will hold us all accountable for the handling, the humane handling of the animals and caretaking the people that do this work. If we build up walls to hide it, I think that's where the real trouble begins and continues to begin for the animals and for the people that have to work in these conditions.
You go on to talk about the importance of reclaiming food, which otherwise might go to waste in farmer fields, the importance of of grocery stores springing up in so-called food deserts where there is no place to buy decent food. In our last minute or two, I wonder if you could try to address what continues to be an abiding concern, namely that one of the problems with this kind of locally grown food versus the food churned out by huge industrial farms is that it is more expensive. I mean, to some extent, of course, that's an inescapable reality, and yet you want us to be careful in the way we think about the matter of cost.
Yes. I think there are a lot of hidden costs in that industrial-raised food, hidden costs in terms of to the environment, to the water quality, and also to the growers. The locally grown food, really, you know, right now, currently in our federal subsidies program, we're not giving a lot of money to the actual food, that the whole fresh, healthy food, like broccoli, like, you know, potatoes, like onions. A lot of the federal subsidies are going to underwrite foods that will be processed and turned into other, quote, foods, things like soybeans and rapeseed for canola oil, things like that. So if we could, I think there's two things if we could do. Work at the grassroots level to say, look, this is the types of food we want. Vote on a platform of food reform. Find out who your representatives are, your selectmen even. Start locally, start state. And then at the federal level, put pressure and say, we want to support the farmers to grow food that's whole, fresh, and healthy. And I want to say here, too, that there's no such thing in my mind as a bad farmer. Like, I'm not trying to cast ill repute on industrial farmers. I think the system needs to change. I think it's a bad system. But collectively, if we work locally, grassroots, as well at a top level, we'll be able to make some changes.
Hmm. And I do appreciate how time and time again in this book you remind us of the importance of listening to those with whom we might disagree, or listening to people that might come at this with a very different perspective, and for us to also be careful in how judgmental we sometimes are, that once in a while people make certain choices because those are largely inescapable choices. But at the same time, we need to work for a better system in which better food is accessible to all of us on a more regular basis. The book, again, is The Food Activist Handbook, published by Story, and the author, Ali Berlow. Ali Berlow, thank you so much for joining me today to talk about your fascinating book.
Thank you, Greg. It's a real treat.
Listeners to explore it themselves. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, we talk about Bonnie and Clyde, one of the most infamous criminal couples in American history. They are the subject of a fascinating new American Experience documentary airing tomorrow night on PBS. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, you'll hear my conversation with John Maggio, who is a director, producer, and writer of this superb program. That's tomorrow on The Morning Show. Support for WGTD's Morning Show comes from the generosity of the family and friends of the late Frank and Beverly Falduto, two lifelong Kenosians who devoted much of their lives to the community in general and to WGTD in particular. Mr. Falduto played an essential role in creating WGTD nearly 40 years ago and later served as station manager and occasional Morning Show co-host. Our weather forecast on this Martin Luther King Day is for sunny skies but windy, bitterly cold conditions, with a high today of only 5 above and a wind chill advisory in effect until noon. Wind chills easily 20 below zero, even 30 below zero at certain times. So do take care. Clear skies tonight, quite cold, -3 for an overnight low. Sunny, not quite so cold tomorrow with a high of 14 degrees. And Wednesday, under cloudy skies with a 50% chance of light snow, a balmy high of 27 degrees. We'll see the 30s by the weekend. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha.